Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is economist Dean Baker, who's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He's frequently cited in economics reporting by major media outlets and writes columns for The Guardian Unlimited, Huffington Post, and his own blog, Beat the Press, which comments usually critically on the state of economic reporting in this country. Baker was one of the first economists to assert that there was a housing bubble in the United States, saying as early as the summer of 2002 that housing gains were unsustainable and that the bubble's burst would cause a severe recession. In fact, his prediction for when the recession would take hold was off by only one quarter. And Baker was also fiercely critical of the Wall Street bailout. He's the author of books such as Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, The End of Loser Liberalism, and his most recent, Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa's lectureship in law and politics tomorrow evening in the Chapman Hall Lecture Hall on the University of Tulsa campus, speaking on inequality in American society. Should we blame the market? He'll be speaking tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dean Baker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Today, wealth and income inequality is higher in American society, I think, by every measure I've seen since the Great Depression. You're going to be speaking on that in Tulsa. What's the biggest takeaway you want listeners to know about the causes of this inequality and perhaps a solution to lessen the gap?
Well, there's kind of two basic stories. One is inequality happened. I mean, at this point, I don't think anyone really disputes the facts that we've become a much more unequal society. But, you know, one side is that this is just something that kind of happened, that it was the natural workings of the economy, globalization, technology, and this is the outcome. And we could like it or not like it, but that's something that happened. There's an alternative view, which I'll argue for in my talk, that basically inequality was engineered, that it was a set of policies that had the effect of redistributing income upward over the last three decades. And it was really these policies. There was nothing intrinsic to the economy or technology that required that we would have the sort of inequality we have today. It was really policies that did that. So I think it's important to focus on the policies that led to inequality, the point being that if policies gave us inequality, different policies could get us back towards a more equal society.
I guess from that first viewpoint, if you believe that it was a sort of a natural order, then there's nothing the U.S. can do about it.
At least for the most part, it makes it more difficult, you know, so it's kind of the order of things. And, you know, people hold that view will say, well, you know, we could do things, you could have, say, more progressive taxation, but that will slow economic growth and possibly make us all worse off. So from that vantage point, it's difficult to do very much about inequality, whereas, you know, I'm saying, well, we had policies that gave us inequality, different policies can go in the other direction.
Now, I'm not sure this is a policy, but it's certainly an outcome of the policies, and that is, since really about the beginning of the 1980s, at times we've seen pretty good increases in productivity gains. At times, especially at coming out of the financial crisis, not a whole lot of productivity gains. But either way, prior to the 1980s, it seems like a lot of those gains flowed down to the workforce in the form of wages. That's changed. Is that a result of the policy?
Well, that's right. Since 1980, most workers have seen very little of the benefit from productivity growth, whereas if you go back prior to 1980, there was a close fit. Wages rose in step with productivity. In fact, maybe even a hair more if you look towards the middle and bottom of the income distribution. So that's the basic story of inequality, because obviously for most people, most of their income are in wages. Most people don't have, they own stock, they don't have significant amounts of stock, they aren't renting out property. So their income's wage income, and if wages aren't rising in step with productivity, then they're not seeing the gains of growth.
With that productivity gains, if it's not going down in the form of wages, where has it gone?
Well, two places. Up till 2000, most of it went to high-end earners. So this is really the top 10% of the income distribution, and particularly the top 1%. So when I'm saying top 1%, think of doctors, lawyers, people on Wall Street, certainly corporate CEOs. There you're talking about the top 10th or even 100th of 1%. But these were the people who were seeing the big wage gains. So your typical worker, someone working in an auto factory, someone who's working in a retail store, someone who's working a hairdresser, those people were seeing little or nothing in terms of wage growth since 1980. On the other hand, the very highest paid workers were doing pretty well.
I think most people would say that trend has continued past 2000, but you said something changed up until 2000. What happened after the year 2000?
After 2000, you also saw a shift towards corporate profit. So it continues to be the case that high-end workers, you know, our Wall Street people, doctors, lawyers, CEOs, they're still doing well. But in addition to that, there was a shift from wages to profit. So when people talk about corporate profits being way up, it is mostly a story in this century. So through 80s and 90s, there wasn't much increase in the profit share of the economy. That really has been a story of the last 15 years, and particularly since the downturn. So what happened, we had the recession, of course, in 2008, 2009, and when we got the recovery, a very disproportionate share of the growth went to corporate profits rather than wages.
I think most people can remember stories after the financial downturn where companies were at the same time announcing record profits and laying off workers at the same time.
That's right. I mean, they weren't seeing a lot of demand for their products, so they were comfortable. They were obviously charging high prices in the sense of high prices relative to their cost. Since they often didn't need as many workers to meet the level of demand they were seeing, they were laying off workers at the same time. So you had many companies in that situation. And that's not the situation most of us like to see. I mean, we'd like to see workers with jobs and getting their share of economic growth.
Well, if this inequality was engineered, what are some of the steps you believe was necessary to reverse the engineering, if you will?
One that's just very straightforward, really right in front of us, is simply overall unemployment rate. We can't just snap our fingers and knock down the unemployment rate by a percentage point, but to some extent we do the opposite. So here I'm talking about the Federal Reserve Board. A lot of talk about the Federal Reserve Board starting to raise interest rates. The short-term rate that's under its control has been at zero for 6 years now, and there's talk it will raise rates likely sometime this year, possibly as early as June. And when it does that, the point of raising rates is to slow the economy and keep people from getting jobs. The concern, I mean, they're not being malicious. The concern is that if they don't do that, that you'll see an overheating of the economy. Specifically, wages will start to grow more rapidly, and that will lead to higher rates of inflation. And I would argue that, you know, the Fed should be very cautious about raising rates with the idea that we want to see more wage growth. And that would mean workers are sharing in the benefits of productivity growth. And just by comparison, if we look at the period from the end of World War II till, say, 1980, the unemployment rate averaged roughly 1 percentage point less over that 35-year period than it has in the subsequent 35 years. And that would be true even if we pulled out, you know, we have, of course, the Great Recession, 2008, 2009. Even if we pulled out those years, you'd still have that same story. So it's not that we just had, you know, this bad event in 2008, 2009. You can pull that out. You still have that we had a higher unemployment rate, considerably higher unemployment rate in the years since 1980 than the years prior to 1980. And I would just say that's attributable to the Fed being much more concerned about inflation in the years since 1980 than prior to 1980.
Now, there was one other period where you saw a period of very low unemployment, and that would have been in the late 1990s. And we saw a lessening of budget deficits, and of course the debate goes on. I know where you stand. You believe that that low unemployment rate really contributed to the elimination of the federal budget deficit. How did that low unemployment affect areas of the economy?
Well, that really was a great experiment. You know, ordinarily we don't get to just sit there and tinker and experiment with the economy, but it was extraordinary because we did get the lowest unemployment rate in the late 90s that we'd had since the early 70s. So it'd been a long time since they had unemployment rate that low. It got down to 4% as year on average in 2000. And we saw a lot of things go the right way. So on the one hand, you mentioned the budget deficit. People often give President Clinton credit for getting rid of the budget deficit. We had budget surpluses at the end of his administration. Well, the reality was, you know, he did raise taxes, he did cut spending, but that would not have given us the budget surpluses that we had. The reason we got budget surpluses was that the unemployment rate fell much more than anyone had predicted. So back in 1996, they were predicting that the unemployment rate would be 6% in 2000. And if the unemployment rate had been 6%, we wouldn't have seen those budget surpluses. But what was unusual here was Alan Greenspan, who was then chair of the Fed, allowed the unemployment rate to continue to fall. The conventional view in the economics profession, and this is deeply held too, I mean, this wasn't just a few people saying this, the deeply held view in the economics profession was that if the unemployment rate fell below 6%, then we would have a problem spiraling inflation. So the idea was the Federal Reserve Board had to step in, raise interest rates, keep the unemployment rate from falling. Greenspan, I've made many, many criticisms of Greenspan, particularly over the housing bubble, but in any case, to his great credit, he saw the unemployment rate go to 6%, and he argued with other people in the Federal Reserve Board's open market committee that sets interest rates. And he said, I don't see any problem with inflation. Why don't we let the economy continue to grow, create jobs, let the unemployment rate fall? And he did that, and the unemployment rate fell to 5.5%, 5%, 4.5%, and then eventually 4% as year-round average. So we got the budget surpluses, but even more importantly in my book, we actually saw good wage growth up and down the wage ladder. So before I was saying how through most of the last 35 years, the year since 1980, the wage gains overwhelmingly went to those in the top 10% or even the top 1%. If you go to that period in the late 90s, 96, 97, 98, 99, 2000, you see good wage gains right down to the bottom, 10th percentile of the income distribution. They were seeing healthy wage gains during that period. And as a story, it was a simple one, that even restaurants, we think of restaurants as relatively low-paid, less skilled work, even restaurants, hotels, they had to compete to find workers. So what that meant was they had to push up wages. So to my view, this is a fantastic experiment. I mean, obviously, it was great for those people at the time, but it's also very helpful for me as an economist to be able to point back to that period and go, look, we were able to get the unemployment rate much lower than most economists thought possible. We didn't see spiraling inflation. Inflation was pretty stable through this period. What we did see was that workers at the middle and the bottom of the income distribution had strong wage growth.
Well, let me ask you another question, which a lot of people attribute to those low interest rates. Did we see the accumulation of a bubble around tech stocks? In your opinion, does that have any relationship?
We did see a bubble in tech stocks, and I would say the stock market more generally. So it wasn't just the tech sector. You could look at General Motors, McDonald's. Everything was overvalued, so it went well beyond the tech sector. And I would say interest rates probably had some impact on that, but I think it was very, very little. If you look back historically at stock prices and the relationship between stock prices and interest rates, there's some relationship, but it's just not a very strong one. So you have periods where we have low interest rates and not especially high stock prices and vice versa. So I think that certainly helped to contribute to that, to the bubble. And, again, this, I was saying before, I have criticisms of Greenspan. Greenspan's attitude towards the stock bubble and then later towards the housing bubble was, well, that's not my problem. We'll just let, we'll just let the bubble run its course, and if it affects the economy, we'll just pick up the pieces. And that isn't an easy thing to do. So I do blame Greenspan for not trying to do something about the stock bubble and then later the housing bubble. I'm saying do something that's not raise interest rates. The Fed has a lot of other things it could do. First and foremost, just trying to call attention and warn about the bubble. But in any case, I think it was a serious error on the Fed's part to let these bubbles grow to very dangerous sizes. The stock bubble, actually, when it burst, did have a big impact. The conventional view is that recession back in 2001 when it burst wasn't that long. We went 4 years without positive job growth. That was the longest period we'd had since the Great Depression until the current downturn. So the stock bubble had serious fallout when it collapsed, and certainly the housing bubble had even more serious fallout. So letting bubbles just grow, I think, is a very, very bad policy. But again, I will give Greenspan great credit for allowing the unemployment rate to fall to 4%, because that made a huge difference in tens of millions of people's lives, and also it gives us a reference point now. I could point to that and, argue, as I am now, that, look, we could do much better. We could have a much lower unemployment rate than we do today, and there'll be widespread benefits for large segments of the workforce.
Well, until the March job figures came out, the debate was on about just when the Fed was going to start raising interest rates. Now this March slide in the jobless figures and job creation, largely attributed to weather, has tempered that slightly, but still it's a matter of when, not if, the Fed was going to start raising interest rates. How will this impact unemployment? Will it have an effect in driving up unemployment or at least slowing job growth?
Well, definitely will have some effect in slowing job growth. Now, a lot depends on when they raise them, how much they raise them, and probably most importantly, what they say about future increases. So one can envision a scenario where, let's say, you know, come August, the Federal Reserve Board raises the rate by a quarter point, the overnight rate that it controls, raises it from zero to 0.25%, a quarter point. And then they say, well, we're going to look and see. We're just going to, you know, we've raised it a quarter point. We're on hold now. We'll see what the data looks like going forward the rest of 2015 into 2016. We aren't committing ourselves to more rate hikes. The alternative is that they say, okay, we're raising interest rates a quarter point at this meeting. They meet every 6 weeks. So 6 weeks later, we're going to have another meeting. We're going to raise it another quarter point. And then 6 weeks after that, we're going to raise another quarter point until, you know, whatever. If they go that second route, then that could have a very big impact on the economy, because that will mean you'll see interest rates rise throughout the economy, meaning mortgage rates, car loans, all the interest rates that have an effect on individual, corporate, and even government spending, because governments, of course, borrow money for things like building roads and bridges and other such things. It will have a very that will have a significant effect in slowing the economy and raising the unemployment rate.
Let me ask you, just from a naive position, how much would, say, even if it was a series of 0.25% raises in the interest rate, how much would that have an effect? A 1% rise from 0 to 1 on the short-term rates. How does that trickle through the economy? Are we looking at multiple points when you go to, say, consumer loans, bank loans, credit card loans, lending practices?
For short-term, for the shortest-term loans, you know, if you're to, say, get a credit card loan, you know, which could in principle be paid off in 30 days, those probably rise pretty much 1 to 1. So if you raise the 1 percentage point, you know, whatever you're paying on your credit card, if you're paying 10, probably rise to something like 11. The longer-term rates, which have the most impact on the economy, say mortgage interest rates, the rates that on corporate bonds, those would rise less than that, but maybe around, you know, 3, 4, 5 tenths of a percentage point. Again, a lot will depend on what people's perception is of the future. So if Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, says, we're going to keep going on this, you know, until we hit 4% or something like that, then you'll see more of an increase in those longer-term rates. And that will have an impact, because people who are thinking of buying homes will be more reluctant to do so if, say, they're looking at a 4.5% mortgage or even 5 rather than a 4. Certainly, if they're thinking of refinancing, it might make sense to refinance at 4% interest. It may not make sense to refinance at 4.5 or 5. So that will have an impact. Again, I'm not going to say it's going to bring the economy to a halt, but it will definitely slow the economy. And if we're starting from the standpoint that we need more jobs, we have to see the unemployment rate fall further, this is definitely going in the wrong direction.
My guest today is Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's the author of books, op-eds, and his blog, Beat the Press, which decries the state of reporting on economics in America. He will be giving the Leadership in Politics and Law lecture at the University of Tulsa Thursday evening at 7 o'clock, speaking on inequality in American society. Should we blame the market? Before we talk about the markets, beyond unemployment, and certainly this unemployment is another cause of this sort of disconnect between seeing our traditional measures of wealth, which a lot of times has to do with the stock market and the like, where we see it, you know, it's still doing really, really well. And yet there's this disconnect between things like the unemployment rate, the average household being able to make ends meet. There seems to be a bigger disconnect. Is this all part of this inequality thing?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the story. So that, you know, we're because you have a higher unemployment rate, and, you know, in other aspects of the inequality, but because you have the higher unemployment rate, workers are less able to get wage gains, and that means that they're less able to, you know, meet their mortgage payments. You know, it just means a lot more stress in people's lives. One of the things I like to look to as a measure of people's security is the quit rate, the percentage of unemployment that's due to people voluntarily quit their job. Now, that's up from where it was back in 2009, 2010, but still way down from 2006, 2007, the years before the recession. And I take that as a good measure of people's security about the labor market, because what this is telling us is the likelihood that someone will quit a job without having another job lined up. So you might do that if you think, oh, it's easy to get a job, I could quit because I don't like my boss, or they won't give me a pay raise, whatever it is. and I won't have a problem getting another job in a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, enough time so it's not a big financial strain. People don't quit in really bad times, and they're still reluctant to quit. You know, again, they're more likely to quit now than they were at the trough of the recession, but we still aren't back to 2006, 2007 levels and way below where we were back in, you know, 99 or 2000, the really good years.
One of the things you've been writing about since the financial crisis has been just the inadequacy of government response, everything from the stimulus and on since those very early days. And I was struck by something I read about a year ago. It was a diary of a Midwestern banker living through the Great Depression, the beginnings of the Great Depression, from about 29 when the stock market crashed, through about the first year or so of the Roosevelt administration. And he was always constantly concerned any government spending was going to fuel inflation, and he was in the midst of this classic deflation spiral. And I'm wondering if, you know, when you hear about all this debate over the Fed, we're sort of in that same sort of mindset.
Yeah, it is kind of striking because, you know, the Fed has been, on the whole, pretty good in terms of promoting growth because we do have the zero interest rate policy. And until earlier this year, we had quantitative easing where they are buying up long-term bonds. This is unusual for the Fed because usually they don't. They just intervene with short-term money. But they were directly trying to lower long-term interest rates by buying long-term bonds and mortgage-backed securities. And you had all these people running around saying, oh, this is going to lead to hyperinflation because, you know, here it is, they're pumping all this money into the economy, and it's going to be just like Weimar Germany where you had, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of percent a year annual inflation. The story was people had to go to the grocery store with a wheelbarrow full of money
right,
to get a loaf of bread. And, you know, it was a very, very different story. And, you know, we've been seeing the exact opposite. Inflation is lower today than it was 5 years ago. And if you look to Europe where they've been even stricter in terms of their fiscal policy, they're flirting with deflation. Their prices are barely rising at all. And, you know, a point that many of us have been trying to make is that inflation doesn't happen just by printing money. Basically, inflation comes about when you have an overheated economy. And we could get there. I mean, you could tell a story that, you know, the economy will start to pick up and we'll eventually have an overheated economy. But we don't just go overnight from where we are today, where we still have massive amounts of excess capacity, millions of people who want jobs who don't have them, millions of more who want full-time jobs who can only get part-time work. We don't go from that sort of story to an economy where we suddenly have way too much demand and there aren't enough workers. We don't get from point A to point B overnight. That's a process that takes time. And, of course, if you start to see that happening, well, then be good for the Fed to raise interest rates. I mean, that's when you want the Fed to try and slow the economy.
Well, my guest today is Dean Baker. He'll be giving the Leadership in Politics and Law lecture at the University of Tulsa Thursday evening in Chapman Hall's lecture hall on the TU campus, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about that second part of the title, Inequality in American Society. Should we blame the market? How is the market contributing to inequality today?
Well, I don't blame the market.
Okay.
You know, I really think it's institutional structures that have set the framework in which we've seen rising inequality. And I'll just give you a couple quick examples. We often hear globalization blamed, you know, that, you know, this is, yeah, and globalization meaning that this is just something that happened. You know, we have countries, China, India, other countries that have entered the world market in a big way, and China in particular, they compete with our manufactured goods, and they put a lot of manufacturing workers out of work. So we go, you know, that's just globalization. Point I always make about that is we've structured globalization. So we've designed policies that make it easy for General Electric, other companies to locate in Mexico, locate in China, locate in other countries, and ship their products back to the United States so that our workers, our auto workers, our textile workers, they're competing with workers in China and other countries who make a fraction, maybe a tenth or even less of what they make. And naturally, that's going to put a downward pressure on their wages and cause many of them to lose their job. But what we could have done is we could have said, you know, look, there's a lot of smart people in China and India and Mexico. We could have said, you know, we're going to write rules that make it easy for these people to train to U.S. standards, come to the United States, as work as doctors, lawyers, dentists, other highly paid professionals. It'd be the exact same argument about the benefits of trade. But in that case, it would lead to greater equality because the people would see downward pressure on their wages are among the most highly paid workers in the economy. So that was a policy choice. That wasn't something that just happened. That was how we chose to structure globalization. So So that's an example of, you know, why I say it's policy. It wasn't the market that caused this.
Now, one of the things you have been proposing over the last few years is a modest financial transactions fee. And the reason I assume you'll tell me why, but a lot of it has to do with the fact that the financial industry is one of the more lesser competitive fields. Is that a fair statement?
I think there's certainly a limited amount of competition in the industry. And essentially what's happened over the last 30, 35 years, there's been an enormous decline in the cost of trading, you know, trading stock, bonds, derivative instruments, because of computerization. And that's basically been pocketed, this savings in trading costs has basically been pocketed by the industry. And what I argue is it would be great to have a modest transactions fee, basically raise costs not back to where they were in the 70s, maybe where they were in the 1990s, which would raise a huge amount of tax revenue. By my calculations, we could easily be talking about $100 billion a year. There's estimates from Europe because they are seriously moving forward with this. So we could certainly get somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 billion a year. So this is real money. And it would come almost entirely at the expense of the financial sector. We essentially would be eliminating a lot of wasteful transactions because you have a huge amount of transactions where someone buys stock at 130 and sells it at 140, or sometimes even, you know, buy and sell in the same second, because you could do that with computers today. So this, to my view, is a great way of raising money and reducing the amount of waste in the financial sector.
Well, I want to leave you with one final question. We kind of talked about some of the bubbles over the past years, the stock market around 2000, housing bubble, which you were talking about well before it emerged on the radar. And it seems like we've been popping from a series of bubbles, even maybe going back to the savings and loan crisis in the late 80s. Are we setting up for another bubble in another part of the economy now? Because you see the stock market growth and just the rest of the trends of the economy just don't seem to appear to be that great as opposed to this growth of wealth in the stock market.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people ask me about that. I'm reasonably comfortable with where the stock market is, which isn't a buy recommendation. I mean, it could fall 5 or 10%. That wouldn't shock me. I mean, not that I'm predicting that. I'm just, you know, market goes up, market goes down. I just say it's not hugely out of line. Back in the late 90s, I was following the market and saying we had a bubble. It was hugely out of line. And, you know, my 401k, I got completely out of the market in March of, you know, 1998. I wish I could have said March of 2000, which was the peak. But, you know, I said this doesn't make sense. It's going to fall. I don't see that right now. So I don't think we have any bubbles, or at least major bubbles, and, you know, may well be some sector of the economy, but not one that's actually driving the economy. The stock bubble in the late 90s was driving the economy. The housing bubble in the last decade was driving the economy. I don't see any sector of the economy that's driving it in the same way with a bubble. So it's very important. I hope that the Federal Reserve Board is on its toes next time we do face that problem, but I don't see it in the current economy.
Mm. And right now, the biggest problem for the economy is maybe to raise demand, because demand seems to be flabby somewhat.
Exactly. That continues and is likely to be the major problem in the economy for at least the next couple of years, that we need more demand in the economy. And, you know, one way to do that, government could spend more money. That's not politically viable. We could talk about reducing the trade deficit. Again, another way to boost the economy. That means lowering the value of the dollar. But they're limited options, and they're political obstacles to anything we might try to do at this point.
All right. Dean Baker, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Economist Dean Baker speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa's lectureship in politics and law, speaking on inequality in American society. Should we blame the market? The lecture takes place tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the Chapman Hall Lecture Hall on the TU campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. Information at 918-631-2338. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.